next case, which is State v. Farron. Mr. Lunston, representing the state, you're up again.
Did you lose a bet or something that you got two in a row?
This is your call.
We scheduled this for your convenience.
This next case deals with jury selection. You're being asked to decide the proper appellate standard of review when a trial court denies a requested strike for cause. I'll briefly summarize the facts. The defendant and the co-defendant were tried for burglary. During voir dire, defendant's counsel and the co-counsel both asked prospective jurors if they'd hold it against their clients if they didn't testify. Two jurors spoke up. They said, in effect, that they thought an innocent person would want to tell their side of the story, would want to testify. These are the two jurors the defense wanted struck for cause. The trial judge entered into a dialogue with the jurors explaining the defendant has a constitutional right not to testify. I think he did it very well. He was emphatic and understanding of their position, but saying that's not the law. You have a duty to put that opinion aside. Both prospective jurors initially repeated their concern, but after a back-and-forth exchange with the judge, one of the jurors named Mr. Metzler said that he would certainly try to put aside his opinion, and shortly after that, he said he probably could, in the context that he probably could. The other juror, Ms. Clark, she was more persistent. She persisted in her concerns about her ability. The judge wasn't satisfied with her, and he granted the strike against Ms. Clark. The defendant challenged the denial for the strike against Mr. Metzler. Mr. Metzler did not serve as a juror in this case. He was struck using a peremptory strike. And, of course, under this court's Ramos decision last year, the defense was saying that the denial of the strike for cause was error, and when the defendant used his peremptory strike to correct that error, it created a situation where we need to automatically reverse the conviction. There's really two levels I want to talk about the decision below. One is on the level of the Court of Appeals essentially getting prior case law wrong, relying on the wrong case, relying on dictum that was wrong. And then on the other hand, I want to talk about whether or not it was a good idea. I mean, apart from the Court of Appeals misinterpreting prior case law, apart from what this court has said in the past, I guess you're going to want to decide today, again, what should be the position of this court. So I want to make very clear what the position of this court has been and why free run is wrong as it stands. Free run sort of plucked out of the various cases on this topic a single sentence that indicates that a trial court must honor challenges for cause when there is a reasonable suspicion of bias. That sentence in the, I guess it's about a 1977 decision of this court, was dictum. It wasn't necessary to the decision. In fact, that was a case where they affirmed the trial court. The decision, that part of the decision, specifically decided to another decision of this court, a 50-something case called Nolan v. Venus Ford. What's real significant about this is that the very case that Nyberg relied on for its reasonable suspicion standard expressly rejected the reasonable suspicion standard. Back in the Nolan v. Venus Ford case, the defendant, or the plaintiff in that case, that was a civil case, but one of the parties was claiming that the judge improperly denied a strike for cause, and they were essentially asserting that there was reason to suspect that the juror was biased, and that that should have been the standard. And this court expressly rejected that approach.
I wonder if you could tell me, so I can listen to you, if you don't mind, and pointedly, what is the standard you're proposing?
The current standard of this court is
you
called...
You tell me what it is and what you're proposing, okay?
Well, I'm proposing that you maintain your current standard.
Which is what?
The manifest bias standard.
Okay, but are there two steps to this issue?
Not as previously articulated by this court. Okay. Essentially...
So tell me what the manifest bias test is.
As far as I can tell from reading the decisions, it means that, like other discretionary calls of a trial judge, we're not going to overturn this unless it's clearly erroneous. And in this context...
What is it? We're not going to overturn it.
The decision of the trial judge on the strike for cause?
The trial judge first has to decide whether this guy's got a bias, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, first and last. I mean, that's really the inquiry.
Right. First, does he have a bias? Now, in this case, the witness says, heck, if he doesn't if he were innocent, he'd testify, right? And the judge tells him he's got a constitutional right to remain silent, and the guy repeats, in effect. That may be, but as far as I'm concerned, if he doesn't testify, he would testify if he were innocent, right? Now, if it stopped there, let's just take that. Does that alert the judge that we got a biased witness?
If there's nothing more, I don't see how you could deny a strike for cause against that juror.
All right, but is that manifest? I mean, manifest means clear. Right? So is that what you're saying? Is it manifest there?
Yes, I think I'm agreeing that someone who expresses a bias, persists in that opinion, and is not rehabilitated, as demonstrated in
that
bias.
So the court shall examine on oath each person who's called as a juror to discover whether the juror is aware of any bias or prejudice, right, in the case. So now we're going to look for manifest. Is that where manifest comes in?
I'm sorry, I'm having trouble hearing
you. I'm sorry. Does the issue of manifest come in at that stage? That the court is aware of any bias or prejudice in the case? Is that where it has to be manifest?
Well, the manifest bias standard really isn't a standard that the trial judge in the first instance applies. It's an appellate standard of review.
That's what I'm getting at, too. Okay, so now that we've got the judge on alert, now the judge says, well, okay, so you're biased, but can you set the bias aside? I'm going to tell you, you can't say that if you were innocent, he would testify, right? Isn't that the point here?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And the man says, I understand. I absolutely can set it aside. I'm not here to do my own views. This is the court's views. I can set it aside. Okay. He doesn't have to strike for cause, right? He's rehabilitated.
No, I think depending on how it is said.
Oh, I said it emphatically.
If it's emphatically said, you certainly would not have to.
Okay, now I say probably. That's what the man said here, right?
Yes.
Okay, now, the judge did not excuse for cause. Did he have to? Was it an erroneous exercise of discretion? No.
Was not.
How do I determine that it's not?
For you, sitting...
As an appeal court, yeah. As an appellate judge.
It's difficult for you to tell how that probably word was said. That's why we grant deference to the trial judge who was there to hear it in context and hear how it was said.
So, the judge just have to say on the record, he said probably emphatically, it looked as if he would be able to do it, I'm going to let him sit, obviously. I mean, that's what the judge said. In effect. So unless the guy says never, can you set it aside? And the guy says no. If he says no, you agree the judge has to disqualify for cause?
Well, again, in the example you're talking about, I would say, yeah, if you've got a juror who firmly says they can't put it aside. Now, I want to, in real life, of course, there are other
real
things
life,
going on.
Probably. Or, no, I don't think I can.
The judge who is watching needs to make a determination of what's going on. They need to sort of weigh what kind of potential bias you're dealing with with what kind of answer and the level of sincerity they're reading from the juror.
The reason I'm pushing you is if what I hear is correct, there's almost no way of reviewing it, and that it's not a discretion issue at all. The way you're saying it, the judge has the absolute final word, the trial court judge.
Well, I am saying that there is broad discretion vested in trial judges in this area. The Supreme...
So even if the witnesses know I can't put it aside, you're not willing to say that the trial court erred by not striking that juror.
I thought he...
Yeah,
and the judge says, the guy says, no, I can't put it aside. The judge leaves him on anyway. Is the judge, as a matter of law, wrong?
Well, in your example, I would have to say, yes, the judge, this juror has said, I have this bias, persisted in this bias, and then said, no, I can't put this bias aside.
He just says no with some hesitation. And the judge says you can stay on.
I'm not sure how you say no with some hesitation.
Well, that's what I'm trying to push you. I misunderstood you then. So if it's an absolute no, it doesn't matter if it's said how it's said. No is no.
Well, suppose he said possibly. Possibly I can put it aside.
Right.
I mean, is that what you're driving at?
Well, okay, that's a good example. What about that?
Well, I don't think that juror has expressed a sincere willingness and ability to put it aside. I think all they've shown there is equivocation.
Okay, so that if the judge lets him stay on, that would be an erroneous exercise of discretion.
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, again, I'm real hesitant to snap judge these because usually you'll have a dialogue between the parties, and there's some context. There's a particular bias you're talking about. I really think it's folly to sort of try to pick up which words work and which words don't work, because jurors, normal people, talk with equivocation.
I know, but you see, we've got to have a review. And if we follow you too far, it's not reviewable.
Yes.
That's the only point of these questions. So let's put the same dialogue you have here, and the answer is possibly. Okay? Same dialogue, possibly. What do you do on review?
Again, just the word possibly doesn't answer the question for you.
Take the same dialogue, the same record we have here. The answer is possibly. Same dialogue, no, you'd say he had a strike. To put in the word possibly.
I don't think that adds anything to it. I think you still have a juror who has said, I have this bias. Yes, I have this bias. And when they say possibly, I mean, it seems to me you still have that same juror who has only indicated they have a bias.
Okay, so that if the judge doesn't strike the juror, that's okay. It's not an erroneous exercise of discretion.
No, I think it would be.
It is an erroneous exercise.
Because that juror hasn't come back and said that they would try to put aside this bias and indicate some...
And what about... So probably is where you draw the line.
I don't want to draw the line with any particular words.
Isn't the problem really that the trial judge is doing more than assessing that answer, but it's almost equivalent to a credibility determination? I mean, it's body language, it's the way it's... I mean, the kinds of things, whether you believe the person or not, whether they're going to make a sincere effort. I mean, isn't that part of the problems with the dynamics?
Yes.
I mean, in some parts, you have a juror who's expressed a lot of concern about the defendant not testifying. It's gone on and on and on how important that is, and then the rehabilitative question is asked, well, are you able to set aside? Sure, no problem. That witness may be less credible than the person who's the juror who says, well, probably, I'll try, I'll do the best I can. I mean, it's a matter of being able to assess all those kinds of things that you have to assess in credibility.
So,
I made an argument here, I want to see if he agrees with it.
You're lucky to get a word.
Is that true?
And I think that's why courts don't require unequivocal answers. So far as I know, there's, again, no jurisdiction in the land who says that jurors must respond with an unequivocal, yes, I can do it. They don't require it because I don't personally think it's very reasonable. A lot of times jurors don't know. They're just predicting. They don't know the evidence. They may not understand the process very well. The most thoughtful jurors out there may be the ones who are saying...
But the practical matter, isn't it impossible? Isn't it impossible for any of us who've expressed a concern about something to say that we are absolutely certain we're going to be able to set it aside when we have to make a critical decision?
I think so.
Mr. Lunston, why shouldn't we have a bright-line rule then? Why shouldn't we take the approach that if there's any doubt, if there's any doubt after the discussion with the prospective juror, the judge ought to excuse that juror?
Because I think you lose a lot of good jurors. I mean, that essentially would be just what we're talking about. That would be a situation where you would require a juror to give an unequivocal, yes, I can. And that's not a very good test, because some of the worst jurors will quickly say, yes, I can. And some of your best jurors will thoughtfully say, I'll try my best, I'm not sure if I can, but I'll give it my best shot, that's the best I can say. And if you put it in context with whatever bias you're talking about, you know, if it's a bias that a reasonable juror could put aside, and they sincerely indicate that they're going to give it their best shot, they seem like a reasonable, intelligent juror, I think judges should be thinking, well, that's the kind of juror I want on my, you know, deciding cases. One that's open-minded, realizes it's a complicated world, and isn't dogmatic, doesn't just flippantly say, sure, I can do it.
Justice Wilkins.
So applying that, just relate that, and also we know that the yes and no answer is one that clearly we would understand, but using the standard of manifest bias, which at least the last pronouncement of this court used, give us an example other than, well, would it be, I'm not positive, but I think I can, that would fit in the probably standard, if you're saying that you don't want to draw a line, but we have to draw a line.
Well, I think you can, you don't have to say, well, these words work and these words don't work. That kind of line, I think, is a bad
right.
kind of line to draw.
And that's what Justice Geske alluded to as far as...
she's
yes.
agreeing.
Right.
I think so. I'm saying, well, if you're concerned, and I think it's a reasonable one, I think the Chief Justice was expressing this concern, that the words manifest bias seem to set the bar awfully high. I mean, what's manifest bias? Someone who admits bias? It makes it sound like you really have to have someone that you can almost demonstrate has actual bias. And we don't want that situation. We don't want to, you know, have it backwards where we're saying you've got to absolutely prove this person has bias before there's a problem. We're trying to find jurors who are fair. So to the extent that the words manifest bias by themselves seem to set the bar too high, what I've done in my brief, you know, I've given it a lot of thought. I have a lot of these cases. This is an important topic. A lot of these cases are coming up, and I've been reading a lot of transcripts lately where we have these kind of fact scenarios. And it's given me a lot of empathy for the trial judges who have to make these distinctions. What I've come to the conclusion, essentially by thinking about it and reading it, is that what you really want from a juror is someone who is sincerely willing to put aside the bias, and then also that we're talking about a situation where a reasonable juror could set aside that bias. So that's the test I proposed in my brief, to sort of give some substance to the manifest bias standard. I think that when you take that approach, you are granting quite a bit of deference to the trial judge's decision, but you also have the ability as an appellate court to step in and say, well, wait a minute, this is a case where this juror expressed, you know, had a personal experience of, you know, was a sexual assault victim and said that she could put this aside. Well, it's not reasonable for a sexual assault victim, you know, who was sexually assaulted in the same manner several months ago, to put aside that experience and decide this case fairly. She said she could be fair, but it wasn't reasonable. So I think you need both. You need a sincere willingness, evidence in the record, to put it aside, and you also need a situation where it's reasonable to expect the juror to do it.
Boy, that situation, you've jumped to the conclusion that that person would be manifestly biased, and I don't necessarily think that's true, so it just seems so subjective. I'm concerned that it is virtually unreviewable, the determination of the trial court judge.
Well, I don't think that you should set the standard of review bar so high that appellate courts are you know, their hands are tied behind their back, that they can't step in.
I don't know how to review it. If I start with the premise that the trial court is given a lot of discretion, I agree with you. You can't focus on words. We oftentimes do that, probable, possible, and expert terminology, we focus on the words. You can't do that here. Take a word like guess, which is speculation under the law. There's a big difference in, yes, I guess I can.
Yes.
I mean, that's night and day in that difference. Now, if you look as a reviewing court and say, yes, I guess I can, if we're looking at that as an expert testimony and say, oh, that's not enough, it's speculation. But if you were the judge and heard it, that second comment is a strong affirmative response. Yes, I guess I can. So, really, aren't we just going to defer to the trial court unless the juror says, says the word no. Then we could say, oh, it's reviewing court, he didn't get rid of it, or she didn't get rid of it, and therefore it's a manifest injustice. But absent that real extreme case, it seems to me that there's essentially no review.
Well, I'm not suggesting that you interpret the manifest bias test that way. I mean, this court and the Court of Appeals have reversed trial judges using an appropriate kind of manifest bias notion. They looked at the record, they saw that while the juror didn't say, yes, I'm biased, the juror only expressed doubt about their ability.
Let me ask you, what if the standard were a similar standard to fact-finding? Fact-finding. I know the juror's under oath, the court's engaging sometimes in dialogue, sometimes it's with the lawyers, but the court is listening to the juror, looking at everything as you would as a fact-finder, and ultimately concluding that based on what he or she has heard, that the juror can be fair and impartial and meets the standard. And then the kind of deference maybe that you're suggesting is similar to reviewing the fact-finding by a trial court. I mean, I'm trying to use some analogy.
Yeah, it very much, I mean, it's exactly what we're talking about is fact-finding. But in this context, you know, the United States Supreme Court has said we're talking about an area that's particularly appropriate for that kind of deferential review, because we're really dealing with credibility, nuances, and things that you just can't tell from a cold record. I mean, you might assume, looking at this record, that Mr. Metzler was real adamant at the beginning, and at the end he was kind of, well, probably. You might read that into it. I think the Court of Appeals read it that way. It could have well been just the opposite. He could have been, someone would want to testify. That's just my opinion. And then, you know, somewhere along the way, with the court's instructions, it dawns on him, well, yeah, okay, I'm starting to get it. It dawns on, this really is my job, to put that aside. Furthermore, the trial judge, you know, has experience with these matters and knows that, you know, this is a common sort of concern. But when jurors actually sit for a case, they hear evidence, they've got a lot of information to process, and suddenly things that, you know, seemed possible to them at the beginning of trial, now they see, well, boy, I've got a lot of information here to assess. I've got a lot of things to deal with. And whether the defendant testified or not, you know, may just completely fall away as an issue.
Mr. Lunston, before you use up all of your time, I know you've spent a good part of your brief talking about why this court should move away from the automatic reversal that we accepted last term in Ramos. Tell us what you'd substitute for that automatic reversal rule.
What I'm saying, part and parcel of my Ramos argument, is that when a defendant uses a peremptory strike to correct the trial judge's error, it's true the trial judge's error, and that just stands as an error. But when the defendant uses a peremptory strike to correct the error, he has used the peremptory strike for one of the purposes that they're designed for, as a backup system for judges who make a mistake, to keep the machine running. We have a lot of backup systems. We use multiple jurors, 6 or 12 jurors. We don't use a single juror, because just a single juror, you know, may not be the juror you want, may not be fair-minded. We have sort of a backup system. We have extra jurors.
Sounds like the same argument you made in Ramos.
Well, it must have been a failure of advocacy. The last thing
you convinced some of us.
Ramos was decided partially on the statute. It says that they're entitled to that number of peremptories, and by not striking, they took one away from the defendant.
But that goes to how you define what a peremptory strike is. What I'm saying is, didn't take it away from him. In fact, the system worked. The defendant had, you know, the judge made a mistake, but the backup system kicked in.
But in the instant case, the trial lawyer for the defendant's going to have to strike this man you're talking about. Because you don't take a chance on somebody who's already said, I have a bias if they don't testify they're guilty.
And Mr. Mitzler was struck. He didn't sit. I would guess the defendant in this case didn't perceive that he was treated unfairly.
But there might have been another juror there that he'd like to get rid of, but can't because he ran out of breath.
There's no indication in this record that there was anyone else they wanted to strike.
Well,
counsel, don't we have to overrule Ramos then to accept your argument? Don't we have to overrule Ramos?
Well, my backup argument, I mean, I would like you to say that there was no error in the first place on this strike.
I understand, but if we take your argument that there was error, you're asking us to overrule Ramos.
I am asking you to do that.
And what, just the solution, new trial? Or you don't have any alternative to that, do you? You want it to be declared that the testimony was harmless. I mean, that the striking or refusing it was harmless.
Yeah, that the system worked, that the defendant was able to correct the mistake when it happened by exercising his peremptory strike in a way that makes the system keep going, a way that makes sense.
What do we say about the statute? Is it superfluous, or what do we say about it?
The statute was working. The statute gives you a certain number of peremptory strikes for different reasons, to strike somebody based on a hunch. One of the other reasons is to get yourself a jury that's demonstrably impartial, so that when you use a peremptory strike to correct a judge's mistake, you are taking full advantage of the statute. I mean,
so
Mr. Ramos got an impartial jury.
So if if the judge made here would be what two? He had two strikes in this case. I'm getting confused in the cases. Two strikes. So if the judge made two distinct errors in failing to remove for cause, and the defendant had to use his two strikes to remove those jurors, in your opinion, that's okay, no reversal.
True.
Okay. Or more than two.
It would, you know,
eight, ten, or whatever the number is.
And as I said before, I mean, if it appears that the judge is somehow intentionally trying to deny strikes by cavalierly denying strikes for cause, at some point you would have a due process violation. You'd have a judge interfering with the appropriate system.
Now, we're not dealing with that case. We're dealing with an honest mistake. Thank you. Mr. Lunston. Ms. Smith, you represent the defendant, Mr. Farrar.
That's correct. My name is Jane Krieger Smith. Yes, I'm the real Jane Smith. And I do represent Mr. Farrar. Mr. Lunston is really asking you to do several things here. One, he's asking you to throw finality and reliance out the window and reverse yourself on a case that's less than a year old for the same reasons that weren't successful last time, because they aren't very good reasons. They ignore absolutely and completely the fact that a peremptory challenge is supposed to be just that, peremptory. It is designed for many reasons, one of which is to give the defendant the right to eliminate from the jury that's going to try him people with those sort of subtle or subjective kinds of bias that you can't establish as manifest and can't excuse for cause. Nowhere does Mr. Lunston cite, because I don't think he can, the fact that one of the purposes of a peremptory strike is to correct trial court error. You correctly found that that's not so in Wisconsin, and it isn't in many other jurisdictions as well. Plainly and simply, what he's asking you to do is to require defendants, when the state, that is the trial court judge, makes an error, to give up a substantial right with no remedy. In order to overrule Ramos, you also have to overrule Gesch, because the only way within logic you can do that is to say that, yes, there is a state court right, or rather obligation, to correct trial court error with your peremptory strike. And if you do that, if you don't do it, you've waived your right to have it reviewed. So you put the defendant in the box of either giving up his peremptory strike with no hope of ever having that error redressed, or he's got to, in order to preserve that right, seat the juror. And if he's talking about a lot of cases he's got to review and a lot of transcripts that it might result in reversals, as he argues in his brief, that's the best way I can think of to do it. Require defendants to go through useless trials to preserve the error.
Counsel, it seems to me that the harder part of your argument, in light of the fact that you have a case that's less than a year old, but that is reversible, the real problem I think you have is to show there was error here. You never get to Ramos unless you can show that there's an error. And here you got a record with the word probably. You got a witness that's sincere. I mean, if he's not sincere, he wouldn't have said that what his views were about not taking the stand. So he's sincere. He's being truthful. The judge advises him what the procedure is, and he says probably, which is probably the most any human being can do. Probably. So, you know, you got a high burden on the defendant to overcome because it's an erroneous exercise of discretion. Why should we say this is error?
You should say that the trial court committed error and that the Court of Appeals was right in saying so, because basically what you've got is an ineffective record. The trial court did not live up to the statutory duty to determine that this juror was indifferent. It is clearly a two-step analysis. The first step is there any bias manifest on the record? And when you look at the facts here, it's not a three-word record. There are four pages of colloquy between the defense, the prospective juror here, counsel, and the court. Four times, Mr. Metzler says things that clearly demonstrate bias. He tells us, first, well, if your client is innocent, why wouldn't he take the stand? And the response is, because the Constitution doesn't say he has to. Metzler responds, well, if he's innocent, why wouldn't he go up there and tell us he's innocent? He's advised again of the law. And counsel asks him, and is your questioning an indication that you would hold it against him? I think I may. Then, juror Clark gets
involved. Don't you think when you're picking a jury that most jurors are thinking that?
They may be, but this guy, the more the law is explained to him, the more intransigent he gets.
Well, what you just read to us, though, was not, because the law wasn't being explained to him.
But
I know ultimately it was, but in terms of the questions, I mean, it seems to me that a great majority of people that are sitting in the jury box think the defendant's there because he or she did something, think that they ought to take the stand, but there are very few that raise their hand. So the fact that they're expressing those views seems to me a healthy sign versus something that's a negative showing some unsurmountable bias.
Yet, one, we have to operate from the presumption that you guys have established that the jurors are unbiased when they start out. And this guy goes to the effort of saying, no, I'm not. This guy goes to the effort of repeating it. And his conclusion is, well, I would have a hard time believing he was innocent if he didn't take the stand and tell me he wasn't innocent. That's just my own belief. And the trial court sort of tacitly encourages that a little bit.
Counsel, I was just reading the record here. The question of the judge is, the question is, Mr. Metzler, the question is, your opinion so strong, your belief so strong, that you're not willing to set aside for the purposes of this case and follow the law that I've given you? And Metzler's answer was, well, I would certainly try to set it aside.
And that's where we get to the second part of the analysis. The first question, you don't even ask that question if there isn't some indication of bias to begin with. You don't need to get to that. If nobody says, I'll hold it against him, you don't get to, can you put that aside?
When you get,
he said, I would certainly try. But that's not the test. That's not the test you've established. That's not the test that's settled law in the state, and it shouldn't be, and it can't be. Because the statute says not that jurors ought to try to be indifferent, but that they will be.
But the final question asked was, can you do that? And Mr. Metzler said, probably. You're saying that's insufficient.
I'm saying that the Court of Appeals was right when they said that's insufficient because the court didn't follow it up. We assume from this analysis that this is all that trial courts ever get, and it isn't. Because they not only have the right, they have the obligation to follow it up and make a determination.
I'm not asking what the Court of Appeals, I know what they said, I've read the opinion. I'm asking you what you think. What do you think would be sufficient here? Do you have to go all the way so that the juror says, the potential juror says, yes, I can set that aside, yes, I will set that aside, or can they stop somewhat short of that?
No, I think the test was clear and is clear and can be used. And it's the test that you established in State versus Hamill and was lifted there from Mainville versus State in 1920. The rule deductible from these and other cases is that a juror who says he can and will give the defendant the benefit of the presumption of innocence, who can and will disregard any opinion he may have formed or expressed as to his guilt or innocence, and who can and will try him impartially upon the evidence given in court and upon that alone is competent.
So your test is the can and will test.
Can and will, and it can and is done on a patient.
And if a juror, until the juror says, yes, I can and yes, I will, that juror must be struck for cause.
When the juror says probably, the trial court who is going to live up to the standard can look down at the juror. Are you telling me, sir, that you can and you will?
And somebody that says, I cannot predict the future about how I feel, all I can tell you is I will do the best that I can, and I think I probably can do it.
As long as...
That juror my question is, does that juror have to be struck then?
That's at that point. If I were the judge, I'd strike him. I'd err, as Nyberg said.
I'm not asking that. I'm asking whether you think, as a matter of law, if that case is before us, we must say that the judge had no choice but to strike that juror.
I think that's where you get the court's discretion. If the court can put on the record from this juror's demeanor, from the way he answered those questions, from the behavior he's exhibited here, I find that he's a competent juror, then if the words lend credence, if the words the juror has spoken lend credence to that finding, I'm stuck with it.
My concern is whether that juror, if selected, is going to require just a little bit more proof than beyond a reasonable doubt, because he's already stated a bias for that defendant. And that's what concerns me. He may accept lesser in testimony than the other jurors will, because it's buttressed by the fact that he had a bias.
Because he put the finger on the scale of the defendant and testified, that's what you're...
That's what beyond a reasonable doubt means anyway.
Well, I think he would require more proof of guilt than the juror who doesn't have a bias if the man doesn't testify. I was speaking in your behalf, but it may not have come out that
way. I like that.
I understand that's what you were doing.
Just say yes.
Your answer is yes, counsel. Yeah, I agree with Justice Stamets. Your answer is yes.
Oh, to return to Justice Geske's and my dialogue with you, I'm a bit confused now because I thought that I had defined or stated a bright line test that you agreed with. That
yes.
It's a can and a will test, and unless and until they say that, they're unbiased. Now, then Justice Geske shaded it a bit. He gave you a little shade of gray and said, well, to the best of my ability, I will try or something like that.
I think I probably can do it.
I think I can probably do it. And based upon your answer to me, I thought your answer was going to be, that's not good enough. And yet you said it was good enough if, under the circumstances, the judge, in determining credibility, et cetera. So now I don't know if you're proposing a bright-line rule or not.
I think the bright-line rule is there. I think there are situations where, as Sierinski said, the court's got to evaluate the sincerity of the words. And absent some clear finding on the record that the words were either very insincere or very sincere, yeah, we're stuck with the answer. And we should be stuck with the answer.
So you recognize this is an area in which we have to pay a great deal of deference to the trial court.
Absolutely. But the problem in fairness is that the trial court didn't give you a record to give any deference to.
I'd like to. I've got the record, and this deals with Ms. Clark, too. 6 pages.
Correct.
And the both of them have the same problem. That is, if the defendant doesn't testify, they've got a concern. One winds up being struck, and one does not. Ms. Clark winds up being struck because she persists, and if you think I'm not characterizing it correctly, let me know.
Page 47.
I'm at 47, 48, 49. She says, that she's got this problem about his not testifying. And she says, I certainly would try, but it would be, you know, I guess still it would be always be there. I would try. And then she continues on, and he then says he's going to keep Metzler, but he continues on, and he says this is a pretty straightforward proposition. The defendant doesn't testify, and that there's this other evidence, and the fact. And the question is, can you do that and ignore the fact that he didn't testify and only decided on all this evidence that comes in? And she says, I would have to say I would have a hard time that they didn't testify. And then he excuses her. Right? He says, all right, I'll excuse you. Now, as to Mr. Metzler, he says... I'm not removing Mr. Metzler. He said he could do this. Now, the trial court has interpreted this dialogue with Mr. Metzler, and I'm putting it up against Clark because he got the two going on at the same time. The trial court is saying, he doesn't say probably, the trial court has interpreted Metzler to say that he could do it. And once you get the trial court saying, I so interpret this testimony, which means body language, tone of voice and everything, what more of a record can this judge make?
But the trial court didn't say that. The trial court simply said he could do this.
That's right.
One sentence. He doesn't say, I find from his body language, I find from what Mr. Metzler said. Contrast that, if you would, Justice, with the... testimony with the findings of the judge in Gesch. And in Gesch, there was a manifest bias. The prospective juror was the brother of the witness. And they went on, and the trial court said, I was concerned about this, but I find from his demeanor, I find from his behavior, I find from his manner, he can do this, and I'm convinced he can stand. And there's nothing wrong with that except that you took the invitation there to establish a blind rule that you can't marry the juror can't marry the witness, they can't sit at the trial.
So for you, the difference in the two findings are, in one, the judge is going through the litany of the kinds of considerations you always go through in fact-finding, you know, credibility, answers to questions, eye contact. Just go through that litany and then make the finding, and then it's supported by the record. But if he just makes the finding, we can't assume that he considered everything he needed to consider to make the finding?
Not when there's nothing on the record to back it up, because what he said is just plain not accurate. He said he could do this, and nothing in that transcript ever says that Mr. Metzler did do that. Mr. Metzler actually said exactly the opposite. This is my belief.
But he did say probably. That's insufficient in your judgment.
In and of itself, in the context of this whole six-page colloquy, yes, it is insufficient. And it has to be.
He said, well, I would certainly try to set it aside.
I would try. And if the standard is and stays, can you and will you, that's not enough. I can say I will try to climb Mount Everest, and I can be absolutely sincere. But whether a fat 42-year-old woman can actually do it's an entirely different question. And nobody asked that one.
I think a difference here, it seems to me that when I read some stuff that you were arguing that the trial court's statement that he could do it was really the trial court erroneously recalling what the juror had said. Another interpretation of the trial court's statement is the trial court assessing based on the words in the record and watching what was going on, that the assessment of the trial court is that he said he could do it. Not that those were his exact words. I'm not parroting his words, but rather he said he could do it. And it seems to me that's a real fundamental difference here. I mean, if you interpret the trial court saying he said he could do it, that is sufficient record. If I were a trial court judge and I had a brother as a juror, I might really develop that record too if I were going to keep rather the brother as a juror. I mean, that would be a few pages. You better believe it.
same findings were, the same kind of record was made in Hamel. And what the statute requires is that trial judges establish that the juror be indifferent to the cause. And once we have started out with the premise that he's not, he starts out by saying, I would hold it against him. That's what I believe. We better be pretty certain if we're going to leave him on anyway.
I'll try once more to give you an argument. This juror, when he sits on that jury, is not only going to be considering the evidence of guilt or not guilt, he's going to have to get over the first hurdle of, does it really bother me that that defendant didn't answer some of the evidence that came in against him?
That's exactly right.
He said he would try, but he didn't say, I put it aside by what you say, can and will.
And that's exactly why he's not indifferent.
Well, Ms. Smith.
Good going.
Assume for purposes of this question that I'm a juror and I'm a Catholic.
Yes.
And my religious training and beliefs run contrary anyway to whatever the issue is. And I'm asked whether or not I can put aside my religious beliefs, whatever the belief, doesn't Catholic, Protestant, whatever. Can I put aside my religious beliefs and decide this case on the issues? And I say, I think so. Can you? And in all honesty, I truly believe I think I can, and I certainly am going to try. But in all honesty, which I think is the way most jurors would answer this, is I think I can. How can, I mean, I don't know if it was said privately or publicly, but in a little colloquy with Justice Geske, we indicate we might be more willing to accept a juror that honestly says, I think I can, than one that says that I can, because it's almost outside the realm of human belief that one can say unequivocally that I can set aside any potential bias that I have.
If the judge...
So I think I can, okay?
The question is, can you and are you willing to? That is, will you? And that... No, I think, frankly, you've got to say, can you and will you? You have to.
So I get...
And if the juror says with conviction and assurance on language that the judge can then say, from his demeanor and from what he has said and from the context of this conversation, I find that this juror is a competent juror and can and will put that aside, then there may very well be facts in the record to sustain that finding. But we don't have those here.
No. So I think I can and I will try is insufficient.
It's insufficient without more. Because we're starting from the premise that the juror admits there is something that would cause him not to be fair to the parties choosing to strike him to begin with.
I don't know the death penalty cases, because I don't read them very carefully, but what about in the death penalty case, and maybe there's no law, maybe you just don't know it, if the juror says, I personally oppose, whether it's moral or religious, the death penalty, but I think I can overcome my personal views. Has the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on that?
As soon as you ask me, my mind draws a blank.
Okay, it may be that I'll look that up myself. That's fine. Sorry. It just strikes me that that's an area where the views of the juror are very carefully looked into. And that there may be some law. You can also do it into a judge's situation where you have a judge on the case, not with or without a jury, and the judge has particular personal views, and there is a request for recusal, and the judge says, well, my personal view is, but I think I can deal with this fairly, and I certainly will try to deal with it fairly, and same kind of issue.
But I think what you...
I'll tell you what my problem with you, with part of your argument is, if I may. I think you walk up. I think that sometimes you give a very strong I can and will test. But when Justice Ballish tests maybe I'm wrong, but as I hear it, Justice Babbage and maybe others have questioned you and given you a variety of scenarios with sincere people who are doing the very best they can, and a recognition of the psychological difficulties we all have and whether we're really successful in putting things aside or not. Then you waffle and you say, well, you got to look at the whole thing.
I think you always need to look at the record, but I think the standard is in Wisconsin and should be in Wisconsin, and has got to be can and will. To do otherwise is to alter the meaning of the statute, is to knock out all the prior Wisconsin law. And frankly, the test proposed by the state in return is a totally unreviewable standard, but is going to, well, I shouldn't say it's unreviewable, but it's indecipherable. And what it will do is give you litigation from now till the end of time as to what the meaning of that test is.
Let me say, let's put your test into this case. So Metzger has now gotten from, he's moved away, why wouldn't he go up there? And then he's gotten to, I think I may, that's the next thing he says. And then he gets to saying, I have a hard time, that's just my own belief, that's his third stage in this. And then he gets back to, well, I would certainly try to set it aside. That's his fourth, if I've got the count right. And the court is still talking to him. And so is the attorney. And then his final words on this subject are, probably. And you say that's not good enough. So here I am, the trial judge. I've read the opinion, probably isn't good enough. So, and I think this guy is good. I think he's sincere. I think he's going to do the best. I think he's smart. He's probably too smart because he understands his own and human weakness. So the judge says, look, Mr. Metzler, I think you're in good faith. I think you're willing to serve on the jury. I don't think you're doing this as a matter of trying to get off the jury. So let me tell you. I am going to strike you unless you can tell this court that you can and you will put this aside.
Yes.
Mr. Metzner now says, well, I'm going to be perfectly honest. I can and I will after having heard you all. What does the judge do?
Mr. Metzler says I can and I will. He keeps
him
on.
He says I can, I will. After this whole colloquy, the same thing except this. So he's on.
Then he keeps him on.
Okay. No error.
No error.
Judge isn't in error for pushing this witness around.
I don't think he did push him around.
Well, if I had 5 pages of questioning by a judge, I would not feel too good myself. Having been on the jury.
And then the only solution left is to use up one of his parameters.
What's that out here? I'm sorry, Justice.
Not through.
She said yes. What's your citation for the canon will?
The canon will comes most recently from State versus, from Hamill versus State.
Hamill? There.
Pardon?
Hamill.
Hamill, HAMMILL.
Right.
You cited in your brief.
It's cited in the brief, and they quote from Mainville versus State at 173 Wisconsin 12.
Counsel, the argument, I need a little help in the argument that you made previously. That is, when you deal with the manifest standard, you have as I understand the difference, I don't know where this leads me, but you have a two-prong approach. And that you think the manifest bias standard applies only to the first prong of your test, whether or not bias exists, and not to the second prong, whether or not they can set aside any bias. First of all, is that a close characterization of what your two-prong argument is? Do I have that right? You have a two-prong test?
It is a two-prong test, and the first part is...
Manifest bias only applies to the first prong, as you argue.
You know, it applies to the first prong, and the second prong would be easiest be characterized as manifest ability to put that bias aside, as evidenced by him.
And in contrast, the state says, under the Lewis case, it's not a two-prong approach. Manifest bias is the test, right?
But not a
problem. I'm not quite sure what he says actually is the test. He proposes his own with no cite to it. He says State versus Lewis is manifest bias and that somehow Nyberg and Lewis are in a posit, which they are not. The particular page and paragraph of Lewis that says bias must be manifest cites with approval both Peter v. Kiff and that particular part of Nyberg that the Court of Appeals cite.
Well, Lewis says a determination by the circuit court that a prospective juror can be impartial should be overturned only where bias is manifest. So
that's correct.
The state, as I understand it, applies that to both prongs, but you don't seem to apply it to both prongs. You seem to...
No, I don't think that's the end of the test. Because what has to be manifest on the record for the second prong of the test is that Hamill's been complied with. And that's got to be manifest on the record, and that clearly isn't here.
Ms. Smith, what's wrong with the approach taken by the Court of Appeals when the Court of Appeals seems to take a reasonable suspicion of bias approach? What's wrong with that?
There isn't a thing wrong with it.
Why aren't you arguing for that?
I think that a reasonable suspicion that is made manifest on the record is enough. Reasonable suspicion of bias should always be the trial court's rule of thumb. Absolutely. And that is overcome only when you can show that this person can manifestly put aside his bias. If you can't put it aside, and if that isn't manifest, there is still a suspicion of bias.
So you're using manifest in two different ways. Manifest, you're using in one way as shown on the record, and another way you're using it as modified.
As clear.
Yeah.
You're using it
in two different ways. It seems to me when you say reasonable suspicion of bias is enough, and that it has to be manifested on the record, that that can be set aside. Isn't the same thing as manifest bias test under Lewis.
But under Lewis only gets to the first part of the question, and the question we're dealing with here is the second half of the question.
But that's a disagreement that you and the state have, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I'm hearing no other questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Smith. Mr. Lundstrom.
What I want to stress is the importance of this case. I think this is the most important case I've ever had. I haven't been a lawyer forever, about 15 years at this, but this is by far the most important case I've had. This case affects not only criminal cases, but it affects civil cases. We're talking about the finality of verdicts. Until Ramos, the standard of review applied to strikes for cause wasn't such a big issue. Because before Ramos, it was frequently rendered harmless by the use of peremptory strikes. Now, this court's attention is really focused on what needs to be the standard. And I think as you look at the prior case law, you'll find it wanting. Hamill does not set forth a standard. Hamill, again, makes a comment in passing that if a juror says particular words, then that juror is acceptable. It doesn't say anything about what needs to be the standard for appellate review. You know, when can you reverse a trial court's decision? The challenge for this court is to give some substance to the manifest bias standard. You know, now for the first time, you really have an opportunity to say, what does this mean, to give some trial courts guidance on what they need to do and to tell the appellate court, when can it overturn the trial court's decision?
What do you think about Ms. Smith's test, canon law?
It's just completely insufficient. It doesn't, as has been pointed out here, jurors who say they can and will may be the worst jurors.
If the judge strikes for cause, what's the harm? I mean, is a harm to the system, is a harm to the juror, but you can't come in, the state can't come in later and say, I got an acquittal because the judge struck too many. Or if there was a conviction, the defendant can't come in and say they struck. Maybe they can. Can the defendant come in and say you struck too many for cause? not if the defendant asked that the jury be struck for cause. That's really a waiver. So what's the harm? I mean, maybe you strike too many. And there is a harm to the institution. There is a harm to the administration of justice. I recognize that. Very bad harm.
Plus, it's costly to bring in jurors, et cetera.
Well, what's the harm?
Well, there's no harm in striking, and this court has repeatedly, and as you did, Chief Justice, in your Ramos concurrence, effectively urged judges to err on the side of striking.
Right.
Even when we wouldn't reverse you.
Might there not be some harm in the message that's sent to other jurors on how it was done? Might there not be a message that if you start expressing your concerns and dialoguing with the judge that you may be gone?
Yes, and the problem with the example of the juror who said, well, if you'll say these words, you can stay. I mean, that's bad. You know,
that's right.
A bad situation. We don't want that kind of situation. We want jurors to be candid.
If I can restate it, I can say, listen, it's your duty as a citizen of this state, and you've got a tremendous privilege to sit in judgment of people, and I'm sure you want to exercise it as we want you to exercise it, and therefore I must tell you that the standard is you must say I can and I will. I mean, you know, I can phrase it differently.
Yeah, and voir dire will be conducted that way. Questioners will gear their questions to get that kind of answer. Will you answer the question yes or no?
Right, and the jurors wise up as to whether it's going to let them off or not.
So you don't add to the accuracy, you don't add to the fairness of the system by imposing that kind of rule that requires an unequivocal answer. I think by necessity you have to accept that judges can make this judgment call about which jurors are sincere and which aren't.
When you get into a dialogue, you could take the juror and everybody else into chambers and finish it up there. You could prevent this problem. I mean, what if... Of just a bright line, or the can in the wheel is a bright line. Bright lines are not necessarily all good. They just solve one problem. I mean, they may create another. So what's the matter with a bright line here?
Well, in this case, what I hope, if nothing else is apparent, is that establishing exactly that kind of bright line where you have to say yes or no, and yeses are okay, and noes are, you know, don't get you on the jury, that kind of bright line really defeats the process of trying to figure out which jurors are going to be open-minded. So I think this, no jurisdiction has, and this juror shouldn't, just this jurisdiction shouldn't adopt that kind of bright line test. Whatever test you adopt, I would certainly hope that this passes. If you have the language, I will certainly try and probably, and you formulate a test and you say, this doesn't meet the test. What's a judge supposed to do in the next case where they string these words together a little bit differently, where someone more firmly says, I will certainly try to set my opinion aside, and I believe I probably can. I mean, that's a pretty good answer. As judges sit and listen to jurors,
well,
that's the kind of answer they're hoping for.
That's got can and will in it, the statement you just made.
Well, I said probably. I included a qualification.
It's like, Mr. Lunsman, you're in that back room and your chip gets drawn, and you're going to write the standard for the state of Wisconsin. What standard do you write?
I put it in my brief. I forget exactly.
Yeah, I was looking through it just now. I couldn't find it. I know it's in here, but...
Now, page 14.
Okay, read it to us.
What it says, in effect, is that you should not reverse, the appellate court should not reverse when the record supports two findings, that a prospective juror is sincerely willing to put aside an opinion, prior knowledge, or whatever the bias might be. And then I think you also have to say, you know, the judge has to make their determination. They have to say, is this juror credible? Could a reasonable person put this aside? And decide this case fairly.
So the brother was sincere, but the court said a reasonable person could have set it aside.
Sometimes you're going to want to override that juror, because sometimes jurors aren't the best judges of when they can be impartial.
I know it's a right. That's the standard you gave earlier in your oral argument. Okay. You haven't deviated. You didn't change it, huh? Okay.
No, I haven't.
All right. Are there any other questions? Hearing none, we are in recess until 1:45. Thank you.
1:45? We'll meet them down at the restaurant.
We shall meet the Stevens Point students.
Whitewater.
Sorry, that was yesterday's Whitewater students at Costa.